We'll be right back. Tchaikovsky's Manfred, the culmination of the Brahms Tchaikovsky symphony cycle. A work that left the composer hopelessly conflicted. At first he was declaring it my best symphonic work. Later it became an abominable piece. And opinion about it, it's fair to say, has ranged between those points ever since. Although Xian Zhang is not one of the doubters. Conducting the Orchestra Sinfonica di Milano Giuseppe Verdi with great energy, commitment and delicacy. And she's back on stage now. Born in China, started out as a pianist and attended the Central Conservatory of Music in Beijing. And she really got her big conducting break thanks to one of life's flukes. Her teacher sprang a surprise on her by saying she'd be conducting a major Mozart rehearsal the very next day at Beijing's Central Opera House. And that really was what set her on the path to becoming a conductor. And she's working her way around the orchestra now, asking the woodwind to stand, the percussion, and all the strings now. This is an orchestra that's made many recordings, including a complete Shostakovich symphony cycle and a multi-award-winning disc of Verdi heroines with Angela Gheorghiu. And as for tonight's performance, and indeed all the Tchaikovsky symphonies in the season, you can hear them online at the BBC Proms website. And Xian Zhang coming back on stage and taking her place at the podium.
Thank you.
An Italian encore, of course, from this Italian orchestra, from Rossini's William Tell. Qian Zhang conducting the orchestra La Verdi, an ensemble with an enviably diverse repertoire all the way from Baroque to contemporary music. And of course, as we've heard tonight, a special affinity with Italian opera. And members of the orchestra turning to face the choir stalls flanking the organ here in the Royal Albert Hall to make sure that all the members of the audience get to see them and that they acknowledge the applause. Well, tomorrow night here at the Royal Albert Hall, the Vienna Philharmonic will be here, conducted by Qian Zhang's mentor, Lauren Mazel, in Bach and Bruckner. That's live at 7:30. But we do have another prom to come tonight, if this applause ever ends. So for now, it's goodbye from the Royal Albert Hall and back to the Radio 3 studio to join John Shea.
Thank you very much, Penny. That was Penny Gore presenting tonight's first prom, which, as ever, you'll be able to listen to again for the next 7 days online. In fact, Tchaikovsky's Manfred Symphony is due to be available via the prom's website for up to 30 days. That's along with some of the other Tchaikovsky symphonies from this BBC prom season. Well, another prom later tonight, as Penny just mentioned. We're back at the Royal Albert Hall for something a little more intimate at 10:15 in an hour's time. Some late-night Schubert at the piano, or pianos rather, Imogen Cooper and Paul Lewis. And that's our late prom this evening at 10:15. Now Donald MacLeod looks ahead to next week.
It takes a lot to get the Usher Hall audience on its feet, but the Chamber Orchestra of Europe raised the roof with their adrenaline-fueled performance of Beethoven's Seventh Symphony. You can hear that, the second of a pair of concerts they gave at this year's Edinburgh International Festival. On Monday, the Orchestra of Virtuosi in Beethoven's Eroica Symphony, Strauss's Metamorphosen and Haydn's Joyful Sinfonia Concertante. And on Tuesday, the orchestra delves further into the richly contrasting worlds of Strauss and Beethoven with that Seventh Symphony that got them a standing ovation. The Chamber Orchestra of Europe from Edinburgh on Monday night at 7:30 on BBC Radio 3.
Well, in case the sound of the organ towards the end of Tchaikovsky's Manfred Symphony just now has whetted your appetite to hear more of the instrument, there is indeed organ music in the first half of tomorrow night's prom, as Penny Gore just mentioned. Setting the scene for Bruckner's Eighth Symphony in the second half, the organist Klaus Sonnleitner will be playing the Royal Albert Hall organ and music by one of Bruckner's idols, Johann Sebastian Bach. That's at 7:30 tomorrow evening. And not to be left out, in the afternoon, another chance to hear last Sunday night's prom by the Orchestre de Paris, which ended with Saint-Saëns' organ symphony, and that's from 2:00 tomorrow afternoon. Back to this evening on BBC Radio 3. Our next programme in just under a quarter of an hour is tonight's feature. And this evening, another chance to hear a programme from earlier in the year, A Cultural History of Weeping. That's at 9:30. It's followed by our late-night Schubert prom at 10:15. And then Nick Luscombe is here at 11:45 with Thursday's edition of Late Junction. So before the feature, let's return to the spirit of the first half of tonight's prom, the music of Verdi. And in case you're a little surprised to have heard one of the shorter performances of the Triumphal March from Aida, let's make amends now with a generous helping of Aida as transcribed for the piano by Liszt. This is his arrangement of the Sacred Dance from Act 1 of Aida and then the final duet from Act 4. Liszt's transcription is played here by Daniel Barenboim. I forgot to tell you before we heard that was that that was a live concert recording, Daniel Barenboim at La Scala Milan in May 2007, and he was playing Liszt's transcription of Verdi's Aida, the sacred dance from the end of Act 1, and Radames and Aida's duet from Act 4. In a couple of minutes, our feature, then at 10.15, Late Night Schubert from the Proms, and Late Junction at 11.45. To whet your appetite for the Schubert, here's one of his part songs. If you've ever wondered what the missing link was between Schubert and the West End hit One Man, Two Governors, and which of us hasn't, there it was. Words by Carlo Goldoni, Il La Pastorella, set to music by Schubert and sung there by the Utrecht vocal soloists with Ronald Brautigam at the piano. And as I mentioned, there's Late Night Schubert from the Proms at 10.15. This is BBC Radio 3. It's now 9:30. And time for this evening's feature. Thomas Dixon is a historian of emotions, and in this programme, first broadcast on Radio 3 in January, he explores the rich cultural history of weeping in Margaret, Are You Grieving?
You weep for various reasons, don't you? I think I've wept in mourning, but also in anger. But the real area that gets me in weeping is if I feel I've been done wrong to.
Music is the thing that makes me cry, though I think I always stop myself.
I weep at anything these days, particularly since I became a father.
It makes me self-conscious, and then I think I become not exactly embarrassed, but I question my own authenticity, I suppose.
I cry too much. I mean, so my own particular problem would be the sort of self-indulgence of tears rather than the absence of them.
It's a bit like vomiting. I mean, it's certainly cleansing, and you do feel the unsayable is coming out.
I myself am not someone who readily breaks into weeping, but that doesn't mean that I haven't deep experiences of, certainly, of aesthetic forms.
I cry in all children's films. I cried at Toy Story 3. I cried absolutely anything, really. The Archers makes me cry.
It's interesting because I think, in certain lots of ways, my measure of an artistic experience is whether it makes me cry, and music makes me cry more easily. But when I've been to the theatre and it's made me cry, I've thought, oh, well, that must be good.
Mozart's Requiem was his final work. The manuscript was unfinished when he died, breaking off after 9 bars of the Lacrimosa, the section describing the Day of Tears when all humanity would be judged. According to one account, in the final hours of his life, confined to his bed, Mozart sang through his Requiem with friends. When he reached the Lacrimosa, he set the manuscript aside, weeping bitterly. Mozart's short life spanned an era now famous for its extravagant emotional sensibility, the second half of the 18th century. But throughout our cultural history, tears have been intimately connected with the arts, whether as inspiration or response. The classicist Simon Goldhill.
Perhaps the most outstanding example of classical weeping from the earlier period is Homer's Odysseus. And when Odysseus hears the story of the sack of Troy, in which he himself had took part in the palace of Alcinous, he breaks down into tears. And that prompts his host to say, please tell me your story. So tears become a response to art in the earliest epic, and also the prompt to art in the earliest epic.
Gerard Manley Hopkins' poem, Spring and Fall, is addressed to a young child.
Margaret, are you grieving over Golden Grove unleaving? Leaves, like the things of man, you with your fresh thoughts care for, can you? Ah, as the heart grows older, it will come to such sights colder by and by, nor spare a sigh, though worlds of wanwood leafmeal lie. And yet you will weep and know why.
I know when I am going to cry. There are signs. The shiver up the side, a particular sort of lurching in the stomach, the pricking behind the eyes. If it happens in public, I have a chance to gird myself. And there are some novels, pieces of music and films which I know will have this effect on me, whatever I do. A Tale of Two Cities, Tristan and Isolde, Brief Encounter. As part of a course I teach on Oscar Wilde, I show my students Brian Gilbert's 1997 film starring Stephen Fry. It always makes me cry. So I make sure that I sit at the back. Wilde is usually remembered as an anti-sentimentalist. He mocked those who wept over Dickens, saying that one must have a heart of stone to read The Death of Little Nell without laughing. But nothing is more guaranteed to make me cry than reading aloud from Wilde's own children's stories. High above the city, on a tall column, stood the statue of the Happy Prince. He was gilded all over with thin leaves of fine gold. For eyes, he had 2 bright sapphires, and a large red ruby glowed on his sword hilt. Wilde himself had tears in his eyes when he read these stories to his 2 little boys, explaining, one of them recalled, that really beautiful things always made him cry. So he plucked out the prince's other eye and darted down with it. He swooped past the match girl and slipped the jewel into the palm of her hand. What a lovely bit of glass, cried the little girl, and she ran home laughing. Then the swallow came back to the prince. You are blind now, he said. So I will stay with you always. No, little swallow, said the poor prince, you must go away to Egypt. I will stay with you always, said the swallow, and he slept at the prince's feet. Is it beauty that makes us cry? Why then do we feel ashamed of our tears? The shiver, the lurch, the pricking behind the eyes are bodily signs of complex thoughts. That's why for some, tears have been a prized response to nature, relationships, art, and the divine. A response revealing elevated powers of thought and great aesthetic virtuosity. Unlike me, the historian of aesthetics, Pete de Bolla, is not a man prone to weeping. But he too recognises the bodily force with which one can be affected by art.
There are a couple of experiences which, for me, are close to what I think for others may be what happens when they burst into tears or they weep. So the first is actually at a Rothko exhibition. And the first time I walked into the room, I felt as if I'd been hit by a hurricane or hit by some kind of force of nature. It was like wind being taken out of my lungs, as if suddenly I'd come up against something, maybe almost like a kind of pressure wave, something like that. And I began to tremble.
According to the art historian James Elkins, Mark Rothko has a unique place amongst 20th century painters in his ability through his work to make people cry. Rothko himself commented on this. In an interview in 1957, he said, "People who weep before my pictures are having the same religious experience I had when I painted them. I went to Tate Modern in London to look at some of Mark Rothko's paintings and to examine that idea. I took with me the Reverend Dr. Giles Fraser." So, Giles, before we go in, what's your response to that idea that people weeping over Rothko's pictures are having some kind of religious experience?
I'm suspicious of it, though I do also understand it. When I was an atheist, that seemed to be the nearest I could get to a religious experience. Sort of intense, passionate, emotional, but contentless. I used to walk past traditional places of worship and go and sit in the Rothko room, and that for me was a sort of spirituality without doctrine. Now, I think it's rubbish.
Well, let's go and see for ourselves. Writer John Banville is described entering this room as one of the strangest, most compelling, and entirely alarming experiences to be had in any gallery, anywhere. And as we come in, we see half a dozen of these vast red, black, purple, grey canvases in a dimly lit space, which have quite a powerful presence. So I should probably be quiet now, and we'll see what effect they have on Giles or on me. So, Giles, did you cry?
No.
I felt that I was being asked to do quite a lot of work, to be confronted with this vast space, suggestive of blood or of eternity or of the universe, but that I was having to bring a lot to generate an affective response.
I mean, you could say that's like prayer. So, I mean, you could say this is an empty space, and this empty space is the space that you're supposed to fill or that you confront yourself or God or whatever. So, you know, you're supposed to do a lot of work in prayer.